Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are joined by a familiar voice, Brooke Gladstone, co-host of WNYC's On the Media. Shortly after the election, Brooke was asked to write a short book about what we're facing. She said she would write it in 2 weeks if it could be published in 2 months. Because things are changing so quickly, she didn't want the book to be irrelevant by the time it came out. Well, now it's out. It's a new pocket-sized book, and it's called The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. And Brooke Gladstone asks, how on earth did we get here? So many of us are asking that question. She writes, we're at a point where we can't even agree on what a fact is, let alone what is real. Reality used to seem so simple. Enter Donald Trump and his team of advisors. For them, she writes, lying is the point. The more blatant the lie, the easier it is to hijack reality and assert power over the truth. So what can we do about this? Brooke Gladstone is an award-winning journalist and co-host and managing editor of WNYC's On the Media. It's a show that looks at the world through the lens of the media. Brooke's new book is called The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. She's also author of the comic book, The Influencing Machine, Brooke Gladstone on the Media. And Brooke joins us from WNYC studios in New York. Hi, Brooke. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Boy, they've heard my name enough now. We don't have to say it again.
All right, we won't say it again.
The copy that you read actually was written by the publisher. It is not wrong. I don't know that I would just... The Donald Trump part of it, it does explain how he uses this fact that we all have our own different handmade realities and how he's made that a tremendous political advantage. Trump is sort of the middle third of the book. The first third, and by book, really, it's an essay.
Right.
The first part of it is about how we are wired to create our own worlds and the problems that crop up. And the last part of it is kind of a plea to try and rise above our wiring, even though it can be almost physically painful to do that.
Well, we'll dive into that. So you said that you wrote this book in just 2 weeks, and you were channeling a new kind of anxiety?
Yeah. Well, you see, that was it. I mean, we have a publisher, Workman, who is working with us to produce a book about all of our breaking news consumers' handbooks. Regular listeners to the show will know that when there's a recurring story, there tends to be a pattern of misreporting, especially at the beginning. There are certain things you need to watch out for in terms of language or who the sources are. And so we have written them about mass shootings, terrorist attacks, hurricanes, health scares, you name it. And so we were going to assemble them together. And then they just came in one day and said, this was about 2 weeks after the election, and said, we've never seen such distress. We think people might want to hear what you have to say about it. And I said, you know, sure, they're dying to hear what Brooke Gladstone has to say about it. But I thought it would be a great exercise and a way for me to process it, simply to dive in, figure out what is the source of this particularly acute distress for half the country? A kind of distress the like of which I haven't ever experienced before, and I'm getting on in years. I've had plenty of presidents elected that I didn't support, that I actually feared, but this was different. This seemed to strike at a kind of an existential anxiety, and that's what I was trying to identify. And what I came up with was the fact that Trump wasn't just, for half the country, a scary prospect as a president. The fact that he was elected shook some of the fundamental beliefs and principles on which we had constructed our realities.
You have been hosting On the Media for 17 years, and I just wonder, the night of the election and the next day, what were the conversations like between you and your team at On the Media?
Well, you know, interestingly, if anybody wants to know what we were talking about the next day, in fact, a couple of weeks ago, we reran it. It was called, I think it was called Now What? And Bob and I were having a pretty much of a knockdown, drag-out argument on where we should take the show. And we did it in our podcast. We have a midweek podcast, but I did a slightly edited version a couple of weeks ago, put it on the show, and then did it with a, you know, 7-month follow-up. And basically, the big argument was, do we, you know, seize this moment to get on, and, you know, let's not mince words, you know, there wasn't anybody on our staff that wasn't shocked by the results of the election. That's a little scary when you don't have, you know, any diversity on the program of that. We've always been very careful to make sure there are diversity in our voices and that people who we have on that don't agree with us have a full opportunity to make their absolute best argument. We never edit to win the argument. Nevertheless, you know, Bob saw this as a moment when we need to speak truth, as we always have, always tried to, but, you know, get on the barricades, whereas my feeling was that wasn't our job. Our job was to examine what happened and why we seemed to get it wrong, even though, it, you know, the polls were not as wrong as people think they were. They were very much within the margin of error. It was the way that they were reported and the way that the pundit class used them that was wrong. And so, we realized some of the facts were very much there, and there were plenty of people who expected Trump to win.
Mm-hmm.
That said, of course, he didn't win the popular vote, and I think that is worth saying, because if you go around saying this was some kind of landslide and we need to understand why we're so out of touch, and we're going to report it wrong, too. We were out of touch. The system, the electoral system we have, the Electoral College, you know, gerrymandering, all of the things that have created a Congress where 50% of the country has 65% of the voting power,
right,
because of gerrymandering, means that even our own representative bodies don't really entirely represent us. So there's all of that. Nevertheless, there was something we didn't get, and it was causing this high-pitched wail from the coasts and the cities and other places that never could have imagined Donald Trump would win.
Whenever we talk about this on the show, I always look at voting numbers because I think it's important. We tend to say half the country voted for Trump when that actually isn't true, because there are over 231 million eligible voters in the country, and 46% didn't vote. I mean, that's a massive number. And we never talk about people who don't vote, or rarely talk about people who don't vote in this country. And then we had 25.6% voting for Hillary, 25.5% voting for Donald Trump, and then under 2% voting for third-party candidates. But that's an important fact to bring up when we have these conversations.
It absolutely is. And as a matter of fact, in the book, when I was trying to figure out what were those fundamental beliefs that we got wrong, one of them was that these people who didn't vote were neutral, that they weren't, they didn't need to figure into our discussion. That was wrong. We don't really understand how our democracy works and how it doesn't work. And that's one of the things, because we take so much pride in our system as being the very best system. But it's a system that did not really represent what the majority of the country felt, although it did represent some of the people whose voices were never heard, who decided to blow things up. They didn't see any justice for them. Now, that isn't the majority of Trump voters. We all know that the majority of Trump voters were actually Mitt Romney voters. These were people who were voting almost purely on the basis of trying to keep their taxes low.
Right.
And, and you know, that isn't something you can just cast aside lightly either. So we don't understand our country. That's number one. Or maybe that's number two. Number one is fundamentally we don't understand ourselves. We don't understand how we process information. We don't understand how thoroughly and ferociously we filter our world so that it is comprehensible and explainable and invulnerable. And it's only times like this when all of our different realities smash on the great, you know, highway of realities, and we're all stuck there wandering through broken glass and rubble trying to paste it back together, that we understand there are certain really fundamental things that we've missed about the larger world.
For your new pocketbook, The Trouble with Reality, again, you wrote this in 2 weeks, and you drew on a number of writers, Walter Lippmann, Hannah Arendt, Philip Dick, Jonathan Swift, George Orwell, a long line, and you grabbed really good quotes from all of these writers. What was the process like? How did you, in 2 weeks, decide who to bring into this book? What were you looking for exactly?
I was just going down a lot of rabbit holes, and I'm basically asking the reader to take, I don't know, about an hour and 20 minutes. That's about how long it takes to read the book, mm-hmm. an hour and a half, depending on. Although people say they've gone back, they take time in between, because it is a very slender volume, if you want to call it that. But it's pretty dense. So, you know, you can gulp it down in one sitting, but then you're sort of stuck with all of these things roiling around in your head. And I put a list of sources in the back if you want to dig into any of them. What I was basically trying to do was to take the long view and put this in perspective. How new is this? When have we seen things like this before? What is the latest research, and what are the oldest observations about what humans do and how they do it? I actually quote a lot from the great old pragmatist William James, his older brother. And I quote Schopenhauer. I mean, it's basically to show that deep thinkers have understood for a long time how the human mind works, and now with fMRIs, we can confirm a lot of that stuff. But it is shocking how much we assume that we really don't know. I mean, look, even those of us who completely believe in global warming, as I do, and we should, because the science tells us, we know what the scientific consensus is. We can all see that. What we don't necessarily know is exactly how or why or in what way. And we certainly don't understand how our bodies work, how we are physically wired to lie to ourselves in order to maintain the integrity, the wholeness, the resilience of the worlds that we've created.
One of the great things about public radio is that we can actually spend an hour talking about history, which you don't get much of in the media these days. And early on in your book, you write about Philip Dick. You write, America's most determined architect and annihilator of reality was the science fiction master Philip K. Dick. Included in the anthology, The Shifting Realities of Philip K. Dick, is a speech he delivered in 1978. And he said, it was always my hope in writing novels and stories which asked the question, what is reality, to someday get an answer. And you write, even after writing over 30 novels, he never found one. Finally, when a philosophy student asked him to define reality, he replied, reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. That's all I could come up with. And then you have another great quote from him about media. We live in a society in which spurious realities are manufactured by the media, by governments, by big corporations, by religious groups, political groups. What did you get from that quote?
Well, what I got was, if you're familiar with Philip K. Dick, and I am a science fiction geek, to be sure. I mean, I also quote Ursula Le Guin. The fact is that if you spend your time trying to imagine alternate realities, and he did that in almost every book he ever wrote, we have to try and figure out how pliable our own realities are, how we craft them. And, you know, so many of his books, whether you're talking about Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, on which Blade Runner is based, where the nature of humanity is explored, oh, God, there was a movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm trying to think of the name of it now, where again, you know, these realities are just, they are created, they are drug-induced, they come in the form of religious beliefs, they come in the form of virtual reality. You know, we are subject to what our senses tell us. And our senses are limited. In fact, in the front of the book, I introduce these two ideas, the Umwelt and the Umgebung.
Yeah, I had to read that twice.
Well, the Umwelt is the world that we live in. Basically, it's the idea that different animals living in the same patch of nature will experience entirely different worlds. Mm. If you're a bloodhound, your world is all about the sense of smell, and you understand things about the world that we never could. If you're a tick, then you care about butyric acid, or a bat, then, you know, sonar, you know, sound waves, and so on. And there's huge slices of the world you don't experience, and you don't miss them. You don't know that they're not there. So these, and I think that if you take that metaphor, you can easily apply it to the way we as humans live. I mean, if you look at the voting on Trump, it wasn't really coasts versus the center, as the maps would suggest, you know, the red and blue voting maps that we were all inundated with. These are purple places, and what you see are the cities tend to be blue, and the surrounding areas tend to be red, and because of the way we draw districts, they just paint the entire state red. So it's a city versus country and suburb thing sometimes, as well as a coastal thing. It has to do with how much diversity you live with, as opposed to how homogeneous your place is. But it's what you see, and it is also the traditions that you basically marinate what you see in. In fact, I wrote that, you know, if you were to distinguish between, you know, factual reality and regular reality, the realities that we live every day, I wrote that part of the problem stems from the fact that facts, even a lot of facts, don't constitute reality. Reality is what forms after we filter, arrange, and prioritize those facts and marinate them in our values and traditions. Reality is personal.
Today we're speaking with Brooke Gladstone about her new pocketbook, The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. Brooke is an award-winning journalist and co-host and managing editor of WNYC's On the Media, a show that looks at the world through the lens of the media. And if you have any questions for Brooke about reality, facts, how we got here, where are we going next, we'd love to hear from you. And any questions about On the Media and how she and her team put that show together, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Applying the realities that we're talking about to journalists or media outlets, where do you think the media fit within these constructed realities and how they impact coverage or the lack of coverage on climate change, poverty, racism, immigration? I mean, it's a big question, but we can zero down and really pinpoint it. When you think about how people don't trust the media, you know, especially this whole fake news crowd, after the hurricanes, the Daily Beast had a story about how the broadcast media were doing 24/7 coverage of what was about to hit Florida and did not talk about climate change at all.
Mm. Yes, we were discussing that on the show. We spoke to people who were at the National Oceanic and Aeronautics. Well, NOAA is the government acronym, and she was there as a sort of spokesperson, and she said she didn't want to really go into the impact of global warming. I thought it was surprising, really surprising, that there wasn't more coverage of it.
Hmm.
Yes, it's very hard to connect any individual incident of weather to global warming, but it was very clear from some of the earlier reading that I had read in the run-up to the storms that the fact that the water temperature and the air temperature was higher created more evaporation, made the skies soggier, hence historic rain. If it had been cooler, there would have been less rain stored in the sky to come down in the sort of, you know, horrific torrents that inundated that part of the country and so on. It is clear that the severity was affected by the temperature. And we all know that the temperatures, basically, we've been breaking records almost annually for more than a decade. So it's astonishing that there wasn't some of that. Now, there were talking points, especially on conservative media, that the kind of talking points that you hear after there's a shooting. Don't politicize this. This isn't about gun control. You know, but I mean, this isn't the time for this discussion. But when is the time? If you examine it, where is the impact? What can you say for sure? What can't you say for sure? Why wasn't there more of that? And it was a little disappointing. Now, it is possible that part of the reason is that when there is an ongoing emergency, then you have the sort of experts who talk generically on the side on tap, and then you cancel them if you've got exciting pictures and things happening on the ground that you think that your viewership or your listenership will be more interested in. And I know that there were a number of climate scientists that were booked on shows and then canceled. I just hope that they were canceled for editorial reasons and not because the press or some of the mainstream media were simply, falling in line with the conservative talking point about what is the time to talk about something and what isn't. But I don't have an answer to that.
Hmm. Well, the thing that concerns us is that it just feeds into the distrust of media, because this gets the Daily Beast covers it, and then we talked about it. And, you know, Rick Scott was on the Today Show. You had two hosts, didn't ask him one question about climate change. Instead, he said he's asking people to pray. And so it feeds into that distrust. As a journalist, as the host of On the Media, how do you feel about that?
I think that, you know, since the election of Trump, we have seen much, much less of that than we have in the past. I really felt, and a lot of other media watchers felt, that there was a sort of liberation in this orgy of media hatred that the right-wing media and the White House were engaged in. It seemed to unshackle the press. They knew they weren't going to win with this administration, so it allowed them to not worry so much about the accusations of bias and simply do, and it would allow them to do their principal job, which is to tell the story as honestly and as completely and as accurately and as fairly as they can. This seemed to have been a relapse to an earlier crouch position, if indeed it was for the reasons that we fear it may be. But I think that for the most part, this presidency has had a salubrious, a healthy effect on the press.
Brooke Gladstone is co-host of WNYC's On the Media and author of the new pocketbook, The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, station manager here at Local Public Radio. Here in this short break in Rose's conversation with Brooke Gladstone, with Malihe Razazan, producer of Your Call, asking for your support during this brief break at 800-525-9917. We have Brooke Gladstone's book, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. Yours for a pledge of $91.70. That's $91.7 in support of Local Public Radio. You can also do it at kalw.org.
1-800-525-9917. Matt, Friday Media Roundtable is really an oasis in the middle of a crowded, fast-paced, headline, click-driven media ecosystem. And this program is an example of how we allow for long, in-depth conversations with interesting and insightful journalists such as Brooke Gladstone. And we have such a pleasure of having her today. And I hope you support our program. Show your support for your local public radio station by calling 1-800-525-9917 or click kalw.org.
On the media, now on our schedule here on KALW at 6 p.m. on Fridays, a great compliment to the Media Roundtable. If you value this kind of analysis of the media, this critique that also says, how can the media be better? What are the important stories that are being told? Who are the journalists doing great work? Your support keeps it going here at KALW, 800-525-9917. Get Brooke Gladstone's book, and at every level of support, you make a difference for local public radio.
1-800-525-9917, or you can pledge securely online, kalw.org. Thank you.
800-525-9917, kalw.org. Now, back to Rose.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we are joined by Brooke Gladstone, co-host and managing editor of WNYC's On the Media, and she's author of the new pocketbook, The Trouble with Reality, A Rumination on Moral Panic in Our Time. And if you have any questions or comments for Brooke about where we are today, about her show, about she's been hosting it for 17 years, and it's changed a lot over that time, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Brooke, I have to say, when I read your book, I appreciated that you were so honest. I don't know why it stood out for me. You, for example, write, you know, enter Donald Trump, and I'll give it some context, but gas bag billionaire, reality TV hotshot. You talk about Steve Bannon and his racism. And for some reason, that stood out for me because I feel like some reporters, hosts, what have you, are almost afraid to say these things, to really speak honestly about what we're dealing with right now. And I appreciated that you used these words, and you went for it.
Well, you know, I do think that we live in an extraordinary time. I mean, they're all extraordinary, but this one seems particularly acute. And when people are flailing about saying, am I crazy? Mm. Am I crazy? I'm not stretching here. I'm using, you know, what these people have said. And in terms of, you know, and the characterization of, say, Trump as a gas bag millionaire, I was talking about what made him so appealing to cable TV.
Right.
I mean, when we saw during the election that an empty podium waiting for a late Trump to show up was on CNN, and just sitting there at a moment when Hillary Clinton was giving a speech somewhere else, that they could have gone to her for a little while, but they decided that more people would hang around looking at the empty podium waiting for the flamboyant Mr. Trump was telling. It was telling not only about CNN, it was also very telling about the American public and how we are so easily distracted and how we crave distraction. In fact, one of the quotes that people have really glommed onto a lot was the comparison between George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World that was presented by the great media critic Neil Postman back in 1985. And, you know, your listeners will know Brave New World, you know, Big Brother runs it. It's a fascistic place where thoughts can be illegal and love is a crime and reality is rewritten as will, at will. History is rewritten as will, at will. Do you want me to read a little bit of that?
I would love that.
So this comes from Neil Postman's book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, which actually offers what I think is the most incisive and impassioned warning label ever issued on our media diet. And he contrasts those two pivotal works of dystopic fiction, George Orwell's 1984 and Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. And what he wrote was, what Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no reason to ban a book, for there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared those who would deprive us of information. Huxley feared those who would give us so much information that we would be reduced to passivity and egoism. Orwell feared the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared that we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared that we would become a trivial culture. In 1984, people are controlled by inflicting pain. In Brave New World, they are controlled by inflicting pleasure. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us. And, you know, what's it sound like we're living in today?
Mm-hmm. And then you write, Orwell, who in 1948 was fixed on Nazi devastation, seemed to have nailed it. But 37 years later, Postman saw that in our time and place, it's unquestionably Huxley. He portrayed a world that leads to the election of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. I think he did. We have, you know, people can see. You know, producers can see who's tuning in and why, even at a moment's notice. We know what sells papers.
Right.
What's interesting now, however, in the wake of all of this, is people, many people, are seeing, finally, paying for information, something they did before the internet, but then the business models broke, newspapers went out of business or shrank to become shadows of themselves. People are coming to see that actually paying for high quality news, they're seeing it as a political act, as an act of engagement. And as a result, the New York Times, the Washington Post, which got money from Jeff Bezos at Amazon anyway, and even public radio have seen an uptick in contributions, big ones, for a while, and it's helping the reporting. It's helping getting it done. And it also provides reassurance to the people who control those outlets that this is something that people really need. I think what people have yet to understand is they need it even more acutely on the local level.
Right.
Because there's a lot of graft and corruption happening in plain sight and no one there to report on it.
Today we're speaking with Brooke Gladstone, co-host of WNYC's On the Media. She just wrote a new pocketbook called The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. We have a number of questions for you, Brooke. Tom in San Jose wants you to talk about Fox News. He writes, mm-hmm. Fox News has taught its viewers to hate outlets like CNN, the main TV networks and newspapers, which strive for objectivity. Trump supporters' hostility toward logic and evidence stems from the indoctrination by Fox, Sinclair, and shows like Limbaugh. Specifically on Fox, Brooke, what are your thoughts about how Fox News has really reshaped the media landscape and affected other news outlets and the decisions about what they choose to focus on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I should probably start before Fox News, because the real reinvention of this kind of reporting happened first on AM radio with Rush Limbaugh. AM radio was pretty much dead. He came and invigorated it by serving an audience that felt that they were not being served by, quote-unquote, mainstream media. their views, their fears, their view of reality, their beliefs weren't and particularly their fears, as I said, weren't being reflected. They were being overlooked. So they clustered there. I mean, if there weren't a ready audience for this kind of stuff, then it wouldn't be so successful. Yeah, they have definitely created a kind of article of faith around it, and a set of values and beliefs, a kind of reality that seems to resonate with the people who want to watch or listen to those kinds of programs. Now, what Fox News did, you know, being run by Roger Ailes, who was a very skillful political operative, was to, I guess you might say, weaponize it in a way. They created a constituency that resonated with people on the Hill. So even though, you know, when you talk about it, the really big shows on Fox or any of these cable channels is far lower than it is for even public radio, you know.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Still, the nightly news programs on broadcast have bigger audiences, less and less and less as people move online and to these segmented, fragmented, you know, this fragmented media landscape that offers so many choices. But they spoke to people in power, and people in power spoke back to them. And it gave those people an opportunity to simply go past the media that strove very hard to be honest and use best practices, and basically spoke past them, spoke around them, spoke to Fox News. And so these talking points would flip back and forth, and they would speak. They were very much, you know, we knew what this, you know, there were talking points that were issued by Ailes on Fox News every morning for its hosts to use. And most of them, not all of them, but most of them did. And so it was a consistent and a coherent message. And it resonated. Whether, you know, the fact that it didn't most often reflect reality, what was really happening, was an altogether separate matter and almost irrelevant. It was about politics, not about journalism. It never was about journalism.
Well, thank you for the email. We have a call. Let's go to Doris in Berkeley. Hi, Doris. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. I just wanted to say, Ms. Gladstone, we are so grateful for your consistent and reasoned and thorough programming, the way you discuss issues. You don't fall into the trap of having just an opinion or going with someone else's opinion, but you actually deal with each subject very, very objectively and very thoroughly, and I appreciate that. But the way I frame your program is as I do others on NPR, but not that many others, but yours particularly is it's a part of my continuing education. Okay,
thank you.
And it's an inspiration and a very good influence on all of us. So thank you.
Thank you. I mean, part of what On the Media does that I think is unusual is that it doesn't speak directly about politics. I mean, we have this phrase on the show that we put things through the political issues or all issues through the On the Media Play-Doh extruder so they come out media-shaped. But essentially, what we're talking about isn't media so much as it is narrative. The stories we tell ourselves, wherever they come from, the phrases, the language that we use, the pictures that we see, and then we talk about what they are. We anatomize them. We compare pictures from one place to pictures from another, and we frequently, very often, go back in history to talk about where an issue first arose, whether it's climate change or the drug war or abortion politics, all of that. These have rich histories that inform where we are now. Gun control is another great one. All of these hot button issues, they have pasts. They have reasons why it's moved this way. We understand how they've moved this way. And it makes things It doesn't necessarily calm you down, but it makes them more comprehensible. And understanding the context of a political issue enables you to cope with it better, I think. And that, in a sense, is consoling.
I really appreciated the series that you all did earlier this year about poverty, The View from Poverty. And yeah. Last night I watched the video of you taking, quote, the poverty tour. And I have to say, it had me in tears at the end, and I'll explain why. You traveled to Ohio recording interviews with people about their experiences with poverty. And Jack Freck, he is just a dream of a guest. Over his 40-year career, Jack said that he's met with countless journalists. He's appeared in so many news stories. And he believed that media could make a difference. It was great to see his table. He had photos of Connie Chung and Peter Jennings. I mean, he's been on all the shows. Tell us a little bit about that experience with Jack Freck in Ohio.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that I've been on the show for 17 years, but I've been doing radio as an editor or as a reporter since the late 80s. And that series is the thing I'm proudest of. And that was probably something that changed me the most. I mean, I had all of the correct views. You know, I didn't blame the poor for being poor. I didn't think. I certainly wouldn't say that I did. But I didn't understand the details of what it takes, what it means, who these people are. I didn't know any people who were in the kind of abject poverty that I met on the show, and how they feel about themselves and how they live, and what is the history there of dealing with the poor in this country. And Jack Freck had, you know, 40 years, a welfare director in Appalachia. He knew all the flavors of poverty, understood the politics behind it. And yes, he did believe in the power of the media, culminating in actually in 1991 when Peter Jennings, the number one news anchor of the number one news program, spent an entire week doing a headline piece about poverty. And he was sure this was it. They were going to fix poverty. And nothing happened. This is so intractable. And something that I've come to understand later, since that series, is that the more diverse a country is, the less inclined its people are to redistribute wealth. Mm. If you go to the Scandinavian countries, which are incredibly homogeneous, they'll redistribute. But the idea of redistributing to someone whose background is so different from your own, who doesn't look like you, who don't have the kind of experiences that you have, people who are such blanks to you that you can just project onto them anything you like, the way that we saw Trump doing during the campaign about Mexicans and Muslims and so on, makes you less inclined to share. Mm. And this is always going to be a problem in the great diverse American dream. And yet, until we regard all of our citizens as citizens worthy of dignity and worthy of belief that they want to do better, that they want to do better for themselves and their children, that they want dignity, they want respect, they want something that they made, even if it's just the mortgage payments every week, and that they are willing to work so hard. You can't even imagine until you listen to the series, at least you get an inkling of it, right, Rose?
Right. Oh, yeah.
Of how hard it is to be poor.
Oh, yeah.
How hard you have to work just to survive. You know, how impossible it is to plan when you know that your plans won't ever come to fruition. Mm. And why the temptation to just reach for some sweetness in life when it's in front of you is almost irresistible. And it's true for every human being. Tests on children who are cheated of something they're promised, the next time they're promised something, if they'll only wait, they won't do it. If they aren't cheated, then they will. You learn that lesson early, and that becomes part of your wiring. It's Jack Freck was an amazing guide for so much of this, because there wasn't any question you couldn't ask him where he didn't have the statistics and the experiences and the anecdotes and the stories and the political fights and all of that in his state of Ohio. How, you know, in Ohio, they, you know, with John Kasich, who everybody seems to feel is the, you know, this the savior of the Republican Party, the moderate one, just held money that was intended to go into the pockets of poor people so that they could simply survive. He didn't spend it. He just kept it, you know, millions, tens of millions of dollars, just sitting there in an account, because people don't trust poor people to have their own cash. Everything has so many strings that in the end it's too complicated to get, or if they do, they can't use it. I mean, they don't get the cash. It's just because it's they're backed into a corner and they can't get out. And a system that is supposed to be, you know, a people that we always hear, we're the best people in the world and so on. We turn a blind eye, and they're right in front of us. This is another way, getting back to the trouble with reality, another way we filter so we believe something about ourselves that really isn't true.
Right. We have a couple minutes left, Brooke. The other thing that struck me about Jack Freck is he said when a story would air and a young woman here in Ohio would talk about her dreams to go to college, but she couldn't afford it, we would get 5 offers the next day. Or a little boy said, I wanted to play Nintendo, but I can't afford it. We would get 20 games the next day, which was fantastic. But the policies never changed. And I wonder, right, Brooke, as someone who's hosted this show for 17 years on the media, how did that affect you? And how did it change your thoughts about the power of the media after talking with Jack Freck?
I guess I'd say that... Here's the thing, is Jack Freck is going to keep trying. You make a decision about how you're going to live your life. And even if you know that no particular story you do will make the difference, in order to keep doing it, you have to believe. And I think I used that metaphor in the little film you saw. It's like water dropping on a stone. You know, one drop doesn't make a difference. But maybe a million drops over years will start to change the shape of the stone, you know?
Yep.
And I just have to see myself as the work that I do as just some of those drops. There's nothing that any one of us can do that will change the world. It's just like, you know, an individual voter, an individual person working... You know, doing some volunteer work or helping somebody isn't going to change the world. But you have to hope that your fellow human beings on an individual level working in whatever small ways they can to make the world just a little bit better will have a cumulative effect over the long haul. I mean, as cruel and as ugly as this world seems, you know, if you compare it to the Middle Ages or the Enlightenment or even, you know, the turn of the last century with the ghettos in which people just starved and died in by the hundreds and the thousands, then you realize the world is getting better. It is a place where there are values. There's that hold, that prevail. You go forward, you go back a little. You go forward, you go back a little. I see this period that seems so selfish and so cold, and as a kind of a step back. But we've moved so far forward as a species. I mean, you can believe whatever you want, right? I mean, people believe all sorts of crazy things. I don't think this is crazy. I think there's some evidence for it. But, you know, you have to have a reason to do what you do. And Jack does, and any journalist who's engaged in this kind of work has to believe it at least a little, or you just wouldn't do it.
That's very true, and we hope that you keep doing it, and thank you for what you do. The next time you're in the Bay Area, we'd love to have you in studio. Brooke Gladstone is co-host of WNYC's On the Media, and her new pocketbook is The Trouble with Reality, a rumination on moral panic in our time. Brooke, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.